Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan again, and today we're going to talk about the end of Reconstruction, corruption, compromise, and the end of Reconstruction. And we're also going to look a little bit at the West and some of the things that were going on in the West in terms of land legislation, also the Indian Wars, and how Reconstruction was again a larger issue than just bringing the South back in the Union. We talked about how the North was recreated economically, and how that Northern-dominated system is then going to be forced upon the rest of the United States. And we're still living under that. We've talked about the South and some of the things that are going on there, some of the legislation that was used. We've talked a little bit about constitutional reconstruction and how, for the most part, the Republicans are doing an end around the Constitution, but they were trying to implement legislation and later amendments, which would forever change the way people thought about the Union and the nature of the Union. But today we're going to talk about the Grant administration, some of the things that were going on during that particular administration, and then, of course, again, the way the West was reconstructed during this period. So, again, Reconstruction is a bigger issue. It's such a large thing. And really, this again, that arbitrary date, I've mentioned this before, of 1877 as the end of Reconstruction, is really not accurate. In fact, early books on Reconstruction stretch it out beyond that. And again, if you start looking at things like economics, we're still living under a recreated United States, and it's still ongoing. I mean, when the stock market is more important than the cotton prices in the South, and I've said this before, you're living under a reconstructed South. The social changes that are taking place stretch beyond the 1877, the end date that historians often put on Reconstruction. The political changes, if you look at the fact that before the war between the states, the majority of the presidents who were elected in that period were Democrats. And then you look at what happened after the war between the states, where the majority are Republicans. That just goes to show you what really happened here. And even now, when you start looking at how you are starting to get some more Democrats elected as president, that's really a result of a flip-flop in terms of the fact that the Republican Party is stronger in the South now and the Democrat Party is stronger in the North. You're still seeing this Reconstruction process continue. When Barack Obama said in his inaugural address that we're going to continue remaking the United States, he wasn't lying. I mean, we're still part of this Reconstruction period. So, again, that 1877 date should just be thrown out the window. You could really say the last half of American history is Reconstruction. So with that said, let's start talking about the Grant administration. Grant, remember, was elected in 1868. He's going to be the guy the Republicans wanted because they think this guy is going to follow their lead and punish the South. And for the most part, Grant is going to do that. He is the hero of Appomattox. He is a guy that had never really cared for the South. And the other thing about Grant is that he's not a very effective leader. And so for the most part, he's going to let the Republican Congress do their job. He's going to do his job. And the two are just going to agree on what happens in the South in Reconstruction. The Grant administration, though, is considered one of the most corrupt in United States history. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that Grant, again, was not a very effective leader. And most of the stuff is going on underneath the surface. Grant perhaps didn't know what was going on, or he didn't have much information about it. But because he's president, of course, it's all attached to Grant. Now, we're going to talk about these issues. We're going to talk about the end of Reconstruction, and we'll talk about the Indian Wars in the West and some other things that are going on with Western legislation. Let's look at some of these scandals. The first one that is often attached to Grant is called the Gould Fisk scandal, and it led to something called Black Friday in 1869. Essentially, what happens here is you have a man named Jay Gould, who was one of the men who's often considered one of the robber barons, quote-unquote robber barons in American history. One of these guys during the Gilded Age that made a tremendous amount of money. Of course, he did this through his influence in the Republican Party. This is a guy that said he could pay off anybody. He would bribe judges, legislatures. I mean, there's tremendous corruption here, but that's not Grant. I mean, this is Gould that's corrupt, and I think some of that stuff is going on, and again, it's attached to Grant. But the United States was extremely corrupt in this period. And so you have Gould going out there and doing some really shady things behind the scenes. And one of the things that's going to happen is he has some insider information that involving gold. The idea was that the United States government, which of course contained has a tremendous number of gold reserves, is not going to sell off their gold. So Gould and some of his buddies will try to corner the gold market. And when gold prices plunge, because the government decides to sell gold, it ruins the number of speculators in gold. Well, this is seen as a scandal because, of course, Gould is saying, well, the president assured me that this wasn't going to happen, but Grant made no assurances. He had no information that this was even going on. So, again, this scandal is attached more to Gould than Grant. But because Grant is president, it's going to be seen as a tremendous scandal, and you know, Grant is going to take the blame for it. Another scandal that happened during the Grant administration is something called the Crédit Immobilier scandal, and it involved a number of people in Congress and all the way up the line, even into the executive branch. For example, the Vice President of the United States, a man named Schuyler Colfax, was involved in this. So was future President James Garfield. So when you get to the 1880s and you talk about Garfield in the Gould in the Gilded Age, Garfield is often portrayed as this guy who had a clean, squeaky clean reputation. But here he is involved in this terrible scandal, the Crédit Immobilier scandal. Essentially, all that's happening here is that the government is skimming off of a securities company. They had given the securities company contracts, essentially, and land, and then they're going to get kickbacks from it. So here you have the government in tremendous amount of corruption getting kickbacks off of legislation they pass and things that they do for this securities company. Again, the subsidies and the other things that were going on here toward companies, this Hamiltonian system, which was tremendously corrupt. I mean, people warned about this back in the early 1800s, but this is what we're getting. The Hamiltonian system fosters corruption. It fosters this type of fusion of government, finance, industry, commerce, and all that you're going to get out of that is tremendous corruption. It's the two separate have their own issues at times, but the two together are a monster, a two-headed monster that you really can't tame. So this is why the Jeffersonian said, keep them separate. Big government is bad. Big business can be bad, but at least if they're separate, you can work on them separately. This is, again, another scandal. Grant is not personally involved in this, but his vice president is, and a number of other Republicans are, so it's, again, attached to the Grant administration. And then you have the, quote-unquote, crime of 73. The Congress will pass something called the Coinage Act of 1873, and this is going to lead to a panic, a depression. what they're going to do is demonetize silver at this point. We're going to go completely on a gold standard. And it's called the crime of 73 because you're going to get deflation during this period. Silver is taken out of circulation, and the people that are really going to be hurt by it are miners and farmers. Farmers because many of them were debtors, and so now that you're having you're having deflation, their debt stays the same. It's much harder for them to pay their debts. And then, of course, miners because they're not mining silver anymore. So the economy is going to take a little hit here. And Grant, of course, because he's president, is blamed for the poor economy. But again, really had nothing to do with Grant. This was something that the Congress did, and of course Grant signed, but the government can do this. I mean, the government can decide if they're going to use silver or gold as legal tender. It's perfectly constitutional, but here we have a situation where farmers start to say, well, it's Grant to blame here. So a lot of these scandals in the Grant administration, at least in that way, are not really attached to Grant. The one thing you can say about Grant that's scandalous is that he allowed military reconstruction to continue in the South. That's really where the corruption was. And, of course, you had some of these guys in the North that were buying their way into legislation. That's also very corrupt. But that continued beyond the Grant administration. So Grant himself was usually not attached to these particular scandals. But, of course, because he's president, he's going to take the hit for them. Now, 1872 rolls around, and we're going to have another presidential election. And this is quite interesting because things had gotten so bad in terms of Republican dominance that the Democrats decided not even to run a candidate. In 1872, you have Grant running for the Republicans, and then you have Horace Greeley running for the Democrats. Well, he's not really a Democrat. He's a liberal Republican. But he had gotten to this point where he would oppose Reconstruction in the South. So really here you have Republican against Republican. And Greeley's going to die before the election even takes place. So ultimately you have Grant win in a landslide because there's really no opponent in 1872. So what we're going to see is the continuation of Reconstruction in the South, and this tremendous amount of corruption that had already been there will be allowed to continue. So that is the area, again, if you want to talk about a corrupt period of time, it's that Reconstruction in the South. It's the things that were going on in the South, not the things that were going on that were under the surface for Grant. Again, though, you do have the Gould-Fisk scandal, but that's people that aren't really associated with Grant. It's more individuals trying to buy their implements. Now, in the South, you had two different types of people that would often make Reconstruction a corrupt period. The first are the carpetbaggers. Carpetbaggers are Northerners who settled in the South. And of course, what they're looking for are political, office, plunder, profit. They're plundering the South politically and economically. Now, some of these people, of course, are bringing needed money into the infrastructure, but of course, Southerners are not very happy with them. You know, a lot of these people were former soldiers. They had just settled in the South after the war, and then because they had buddies that were Republicans, they're elected to Senate positions or in the House of Representatives or the state governments, governors. And so a lot of times these people would set tax rates very high so they could go out and get these plantations, steal them from Southerners. I mean, that's the way this stuff was looked at. And the carpetbaggers were considered, you know, lower than just about anybody else. There was only one group that was lower than them in the South, and it's not African Americans. It would be scalawags. So you have these carpetbaggers really disrupting things in the South and taking away political office from native Southerners. And so they were vilified for this. They are providing at times, some of them, some needed money, but for the most part, these people are getting rich. They didn't really bring much with them. The other group that's vilified, perhaps more vilified than carpetbaggers, are called scalawags. Scalawags are Southerners who became Republicans in this period, and the most famous would be James Longstreet. Longstreet, of course, was Lee's right-hand man in the final years of the war after Thomas Jackson was killed. So Longstreet will turn coat. He'll become a Republican. And if you look at histories of the war written after Longstreet does this, Longstreet takes the blame, the entire blame for the loss of the war, because Southerners hated this guy. And there were a number of others. I mean, anyone that was a Republican who supported the Republican Party in the South, and they're from the South, these people are considered lower than the dirt on your shoe. They're not well respected. They're not liked. Longstreet's position simply was, of course, he was friends with Grant, that he might be able to do more good by being a Republican than working against them all the time. Maybe he could work with them and try to mitigate the evils of Reconstruction. But anytime you became a Republican, you were just seen as a bad person. In fact, Republicans really won't make headway in the South until really the 1960s. So it's a very long period of time, 100 years, before you have any type of Republican dominance of the South. And that's because of the lingering effects of the war and Reconstruction. So scalawags were lower than carpetbaggers. And when I talked about these Southern paramilitary organizations in the last discussion, they were going after scalawags and carpetbaggers more than they would black Southerners. So these people were really the targets, not necessarily black Southerners all the time. Now, what's going to happen when you get these carpetbaggers and scalawags in the government? You're going to have tremendous state corruption. These state governments go wild on spending and taxing. I mean, it's obnoxious in what they're doing. You had prominent scalawags in Mississippi and Louisiana. You had scalawags dominating the Reconstruction governments in Alabama and South Carolina. Carpetbaggers were elected to United States Senate positions. And most of these people are supporting a different economy for the South. They're trying to get away from the agrarian South and into a more industrialized South. So this is really the beginning of what we call the New South. It would take some time for this to work, but by the 1970s, of course, you have a new South, a South that's been completely reconstructed economically. All of these governments, again, were spending excessively. You know, for example, in South Carolina, the state debt doubled in this particular period of time because these governments would just go in and spend like they're drunk. And again, this is part of that Hamiltonian ideology where the government is going to spend money for infrastructure and other things that they really don't have at times. Eventually, you know, Hamilton said a little debt's a good thing. These people weren't necessarily worried about having a balanced budget and a solid government in terms of spending. That wasn't an issue. They're just going to spend like crazy. And then, of course, on the other end, they're going to start taxing like crazy. And the objective of the taxes oftentimes, again, was to try to get these Southerners off their plantations and confiscate that land for themselves. So it wasn't direct confiscation. It was backhanded confiscation. But some of the stuff is going to happen. Also, they're going to be involved in trying to suppress the vote of white Southerners. So you had on both ends, as these Southern paramilitary organizations would try to suppress the vote of their opponents, so would these carpetbag and scalawag governments try to suppress the vote of white Southerners. I mean, this stuff is documented. You don't often hear about that. And of course, because the South seceded and you have white Southerners who supposedly these evil guys, that stuff is not often talked about by historians. They deserved it. Well, did they really? I mean, these people are living in this section. We have free government. And if they're there and they're citizens, they should be able to vote. But that didn't always happen. So what's going to happen over time in the 1860s and 70s is you're going to have something called the Bourbon Redemption. And the Bourbon Redemption, quote-unquote Bourbon Redemption, is called that because what you're going to get is the return of these older families back to power in the South. In the late 1860s to the 1870s, you know, by 1877. The Bourbon term, of course, comes from the fact that after the French Revolution, you had the Restoration, and the Bourbons came back on the throne in France. So that's essentially, this is a slap at these old families, saying these people are just like the old royalty in France. Really not. I mean, but you are going to get a return of white Democrat control of the South between the years of about 1868-69 until 1877. Again, this is resistance to radical Reconstruction. These old families, as they gain power again, will start kicking out these scalawags and carpetbaggers from the government. One of the things that's interesting, this happens in South Carolina, as the Bourbon government, the restoration of the government to white Democrat control goes in the front door of the state house, the scalawags are exiting the back door right about the same time. So, you know, this violent situation will actually calm down after you get the restoration of these governments to white Democrat control. The violence essentially disappears for over a decade in the South. So that's often not talked about. Race relations, for example, under the Bourbon Redemption were relatively fluid in the South. It wasn't until you start getting that generation of men dying off by the 1890s that you're going to get Jim Crow and some of the things that go on in the South after that. So the Bourbon Redemption is considered the time period when white Democrats actually took back control of the South. Now, this brings us to the 1876 presidential election. The Democrats are going to nominate Samuel Tilden of New York, and his platform was an anti-Reconstruction platform. He wanted to bring the troops home, get them out of the South, return the South to its natural status as a co-equal part of the Union. And so this is going to be very, very popular. His opponent in 1876 is going to be Rutherford B. Hayes. Now, Hayes, of course, had a great reputation as a war hero. He's from Ohio. But what's going to happen here is quite interesting. What you're going to get is a disputed election. There are three states essentially still under military Reconstruction, South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana in 1876. And the election returns in South Carolina and Florida are going to be very important because what happens in those two states is that you're going to get a disputed election return. You're going to get two different returns. One set of returns says that Tilden wins in those states. One set of returns says that Hayes wins in those states. Well, this matters. Because Tilden actually wins the popular vote. And if he wins Florida and South Carolina, he wins in the Electoral College. But if Hayes wins those two states, he wins the Electoral College, and so he will become president. So there's actually discussion in 1876 about another war. Because what happens here is Southerners are starting to say, you're not even going to give us a fair election. We won fair and square in this election. The Democrats won, and you're going to take it from us again? Well, why do we even want to be part of this union? So you have this very tense situation in 1876, and this is actually current because, you know, when you look at, for example, the 2000 presidential election, when Al Gore won the popular vote, but George W. Bush wins in the Electoral College, I mean, people were raising a big stink about this. Well, how can that happen? Well, it's happened before. It happened also not just in 1876, but it happened to Grover Cleveland. It happened to Andrew Jackson, essentially. So, I mean, this stuff has happened before. And it's the way the system is set up. The Electoral College determines the president, not the popular vote. So, but Democrats are saying, we've had enough here. You won't even give us you won't even let us win fair and square. You're going to steal it from us again. So C. Van Woodward, who's a very famous historian, formulated a theory that there was actually a compromise here. He called it the Compromise of 1877. According to this theory, the North and South struck a deal. Hayes would be elected president. And in return, Reconstruction is ended in the South, military Reconstruction. The troops come home. You would get a Southern Democrat to the cabinet. You would get support for Southern industrialization, and you would get a Southern Transcontinental Railroad. So this deal apparently makes it through a committee, you know, these smoke-filled rooms where they decide, okay, the powers that be, this is how it's going to work. Well, not really. I think that basically what happened is you did have a election committee set up, and the Republicans just rammed it down the Democrats' throat. This is what you're going to get. And for the most part, because Hayes promised to bring the troops out of the South, that was going to be it. There wasn't going to be armed resistance to this, because essentially that's what the South wanted anyways. So this compromise wasn't really much of a compromise. It was just the way things worked out. But the important thing about it, of course, is that 1877, the troops do come home. They leave South Carolina. They leave Florida. 1876, they leave Louisiana. So the troops are out of the South, and the South is able to operate freely for the first time since before the war, or essentially, you could even say during the war, 1865. But under this union, this is the first time the South has been able to operate freely since before the war under this union. So that ends Reconstruction. Now, Hayes, of course, will be the 19th president of the United States, and he will bring the troops home. Though the Hayes administration is more important for the next half of this course, not this half. So that said, that ends Reconstruction. Now, let me talk about one area that I have not discussed yet, and that, of course, is the West. The West is an interesting area of the country. It is the most diverse area of the country. You have the hottest places in the country, the driest places in the country, also the wettest places and the coldest places in the country. You have the highest mountains. You also have some of the lowest elevation areas of the country. So the West is often a misunderstood area. It's very diverse. And what a lot of people don't realize is once you leave that Mississippi River area, it is very dry, whether it's cold or hot. It's very, very dry. And so in the 1860s, the government is actually going to commission a man named John Wesley Powell to go west. It's called the Powell Expedition, the Powell Geographic Expedition, I should say. He's going to go west, and he's going to determine the feasibility of settlement in these western areas. And what's going to happen here is quite interesting. Powell's going to come back and tell the government, we shouldn't be settling out west. It's very, very dry. There's no way you can sustain agriculture out there, really. I mean, you know, large-scale agriculture. There's no way that people can live out here. They're just not going to have enough water. Of course, what's going to happen over time is that the government ignores him. And not just that, they're going to start diverting rivers around out there to try to get water to different places. But today, this is how we settle the desert. But Powell was saying back in the 1860s, perhaps we shouldn't settle out there. This could cause problems in the future. And if you look at some of the things that are going on with water issues in the West, it is a problem. Water is an issue out West. There are severe droughts out there at times. When you get into the 20th century, you have the Dust Bowl, which, of course, was partly, the farming and agriculture was partly responsible for that, and a very dry area didn't rain. You have severe droughts in Texas until they tapped the big underground aquifer there. There was hardly any water out there, and that is running out of water now. So these issues of what they're going to do about water, I mean, Powell had made the recommendation not to settle out there, you know, over 100 years ago. And perhaps Americans are reaping what they sow now in the West. This is a tough area to settle. But again, the Republicans are going to ignore Powell's recommendations, and they're going to go like crazy to try to get settlement out there. In fact, there's a tremendous amount of fraud and corruption involved in this. We talked about the Corinne Mobilier scandal. I mean, that was part of it. But in 1862, during the war, the Republicans are going to pass a homestead law. The West had long wanted one. And, of course, the alliance between the West and the North, which I talked about before the war, now is going to get their wish here. This is part of Reconstruction. The homestead legislation said that you can get 160 acres of land for free as long as you agree to farm it, or put a home on it. 5 years of farming or put a home on it. Well, that's going to lead to some corruption, some fraud, because what's going to happen is some of these railroad companies are going to get this land, and all they're going to do is simply put a house out there and say somebody's living on it when really no one is. And so they're going to get some of the best land so they can build their rail lines. But this is going to move people out west. And again, this is a deal that the North cut with the West. And this is part of that populist movement. As these farmers get out there, they got their end of the deal. But when this Hamiltonian system starts to crush them, they turn their backs on it and say, well, maybe we cut a deal on the wrong side. Perhaps we should have sided with the agrarian section that wasn't going to do this instead of the industrial section that is doing this. Because these railroad companies, of course, are making tremendous amount of money on government subsidies and handouts and other things. So This is definitely a part, leads in a way to the populist revolt of the late 19th century. The Timber Culture Act, again, passed during Reconstruction, 1873. You can get more land, 160 additional acres, if you plant 40 acres of trees. So now here's more land that we'll give you. And then you get the Desert Land Act of 1877, right about the time of the end of Reconstruction. They'll give you even more land for $1.25 an acre. This is actually 640 acres of land as long as you agree to irrigate a part of it. So we're just giving land away out west to try to get people to settle out there when John Wesley Powell said, don't do it. But this is all, again, part of remaking the West. You're getting northerners, a tremendous number of northerners for the most part, moving out west. You are getting southerners, too. As the war ends, you get a lot of southerners moving out west because they want to get out of the South. And some of these people are taking advantage of this. But this is settling the West. And, of course, as these people move out there, it's going to put pressure on the American Indian tribes around the West. And so that's going to be another part of Reconstruction. White settlement of the West. It's an ongoing process. And then, of course, you're going to take these Indian tribes who are resisting this expansion, and you're going to send the Union Army out there. When they're done beating up on the South, now they can go beat up on the Indian tribes. So between 1860 and 1917, you have a series of Indian wars out west. And these are often very brutal wars. The brutality of these wars is not often talked about, but you get the impression that it was only the Americans who were brutal here, but I think that overall, if you look at the culture of these tribes in the West, they also had a very violent culture. For example, the Sioux had a ritual where in order to prove your manhood, you had to hang on a post. You actually drove a post through the skin in your back, and you hung there. Very, very painful. So they had a very violent way of looking at life oftentimes, and the Sioux warriors in particular. Of course, you've seen in movies and other things some of the things that happened, scalpings and this kind of stuff, and that stuff did happen. So this was not a situation for the faint of heart. And as these things would happen, these atrocities would happen, white Americans would return in kind the brutality of these things. And there's all kinds of documented situations in history of American brutality towards the Indian tribes. And again, there's a lot of it towards white settlers as well. So these conflicts are going to intensify. These Indian wars are going to intensify as more and more Americans move out during the 1860s and then on beyond in the 70s and 80s. Almost all the fighting here, though, took place between the U.S. cavalry and the various tribes. And you had major wars beginning in 1862 and lasting until 1877. One of the most important in terms of a blight on the Lincoln administration was something called the Dakota War. The Sioux here led a war against the United States in 1862. This took place in Minnesota. And what's going to happen is the Union Army is going to round up, if they don't kill, they're going to round up the leaders. If they don't kill them at first, they're going to round up the leaders of this particular tribe. And they're going to conduct the largest mass execution in American history. 38 men are going to be killed at one time in a hanging on the gallows. And Lincoln ordered this. I mean, here's a benevolent guy who supposedly loves all people of color ordering the mass execution of 38 people simply because one of the reasons was because they wouldn't convert to Christianity. I mean, that was part of the deal. They wouldn't give up their culture. So Lincoln, the great benevolent dictator, is out there executing members of the American Indian tribes because, again, they opposed expansion into Minnesota. Also, it's important to note, and I did talk about this during the war, the five civilized tribes of the South opposed the Union Army. And so they're going to face retribution once the war's over from the Union because they opposed them. You're also going to have something called Red Clouds War between 1866 and 1868. This was the most successful Indian war against the United States. So a Red Cloud will actually secure something called the Treaty of Fort Laramie. And the Treaty of Fort Laramie will supposedly keep the United States out of the West, at least out of the Dakotas, legally. It's supposed to. But, of course, the United States is going to violate the treaty. And this is going to lead to more heartache and conflict among the tribes in the United States. And again, what you have to look at here is who's running the show out west. William Tecumseh Sherman and Philip Sheridan, for the most part. These are the guys that are in charge of rooting out the Indian tribes in the West. They had done a very good job in burning out the Shenandoah Valley and burning the South and marching to Atlanta and others. I mean, these are the total war guys. And so when they go out West, they begin that total war strategy in the West. If you don't have Southerners to beat up on, you beat up on the Indian tribes. So total war, you know, not just attacking the soldiers of these Indian tribes, but going after the villages themselves, rooting them out, forcing these people onto reservations. And we'll talk about that in a minute, but I mean, that was part of Reconstruction. You're reconstructing the West. You're getting all these Americans to move out West, and then you're taking the Indian tribes, forcing them onto reservations, and then you're forcing them to assimilate to American culture. That was part of something called the Dawes Act, and I'll talk about that in 1 second. But ultimately, in the 1860s and 70s, you're still going to have, again, resistance. The most famous example of this would be when the Sioux actually start fighting the United States again after the United States violated the Treaty of Fort Laramie. And this is going to lead to the most famous battle in the West, the Battle of Little Bighorn in 1876. You have George Custer, who was a Union war veteran, a cavalry commander, strike out to try to end this war, or at least try to strike a blow at the Sioux here in 1876. He's outnumbered 3-1 and ultimately slaughtered. Every man essentially will be killed in his unit, and Custer himself will be castrated and scalped. There's tremendous violence here, and this is really the exception rather than the rule, though. You know, Custer's defeat at the Battle of Little Bighorn was one of the few times, of course, Red Cloud's War as well, when the United States is going to lose, when the cavalry is going to lose. For the most part, they don't. And what most people don't realize is there was a follow-up to this. The American cavalry is going to go in and follow up and thoroughly rout the Sioux after this point. So this is it. I mean, by 1877, really the tribes aren't putting up much resistance at all. And by 1890, if you look at just the Plains Indian tribes, I mean, the war is over. Now, there is going to be some resistance down the Southwest into the 20th century. Geronimo, for example, will be resisting later on. But for the most part, the wars are over. And that's because the cavalry does a much better job than the tribes in rooting out the tribes. I mean, they hold the land for American settlers. And again, what happens here is quite interesting. You're going to get the Republicans, as part of this Reconstruction era, start trying to legislate for the tribes and start trying to get them to assimilate to American culture. That's what the reservations were all about. William Dawes, who was a radical Republican from the North, he comes up with something called the Dawes Commission. And the idea was to convert Indians to Christianity, to give them schools, to try to get them to be like white settlers. So again, part of Reconstruction. They're doing the same exact thing in the South with former slaves, freedmen. Now they're just bringing that policy into the West. So you had total war, which was done on the South at the end of the war, a terrible situation. You have the Dawes Act, which now is going after the culture of the Indian tribes. You have American settlers going out West in this bargain that they had cut to get the homestead legislation. They'll support the Hamiltonian system. So the entire United States now has been reconstructed or recreated. Again, that is the entire picture here. That's really what this is all about. We're recreating the Union. We're not reconstructing the Union, we're recreating the Union. And I think that's something that needs to be emphasized whenever you talk about Reconstruction. It's not really Reconstruction, it's recreation. And when you start looking at things like the New South and the Gilded Age and the creation of the Federal Reserve in the 20th century and all the things that happened beyond that, the seeds of that are sown here during recreation of the United States. So Reconstruction or recreation lasts all the way up until the late 20th century, perhaps is even ongoing. The social issues we talked about, minority rights, all these things, quote-unquote minority rights, all these things are part of this Reconstruction period, and they continue on beyond 1877. It's just that historians who try to keep things neat and clean will cut off here at 1877, and then you pick up with the second half of the course. When in reality, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, you should cut things off at 1865, because that is the end of the Union of the Founders. From here forward, you have a recreated Union.